Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, Project Zion listeners, and welcome to No Filter, a new discussion thread here on the Project Zion podcast, where we're going to be talking about issues of sex and faith. Now, we're aware that this content might not be appropriate for young children, so if you're a parent or a responsible adult in a child's life, please take note. Our guest today is Lisa Butterworth. Lisa has a master's degree in clinical mental health counseling from Idaho State and received 2 undergrad degrees in special education and history from Utah State University. Lisa has been passionate in working towards women's issues for over a decade, and she is dedicating her career to helping individuals, couples, and families in their goals towards mental health, healthy relationships, and self-actualization. She's the founder of the popular Feminist Mormon Housewives blog and website support group. So Lisa, you have been interviewed on many podcasts, and you are the founder of Feminist Mormon Housewives, so you're familiar to many of our listeners who come from an LDS background, but you're less known to Community of Christ folks who might be listening to Project Zion. So what would you like to share about yourself by way of helping folks get to know you a little bit?
That's a great question. I grew up in Utah, as one might expect, and had a pretty traditional mainstream LDS Mormon upbringing. Sort of went through a faith transition in my late teens and early 20s and remained pretty active in the church throughout most of that 20, 30 years since, but became a feminist in the process and blogged about that since 2004. So that's a lot of years, I guess. And my kids are teenagers. I'm not a housewife anymore, even though that's the title of the blog. But I was for most of the years of doing that. But then I went back to school, and then I've been working the last few years. And I don't know how the Community of Christ in general feels about feminism. But on the whole, I'm not a terribly scary feminist. I'm pretty boring and traditional as far as my life goes. So
a boring and traditional feminist. I'm intrigued by that. So could you say a little bit about what your working professional life is? Because it will help frame for our listeners why today we're talking about faith and sex.
Yeah, you know, I struggle sometimes to think of my blogging as my professional life because I never got paid for it. But it is, you know, where I put my sort of professional fervor for the last dozen years or however long it's been. And so in that capacity, I was, you know, a writer and a leader of a community of women. I obviously went back to school. And it was a lot really motivated by the pain that I was seeing in that community, by, you know, the mental health needs that were clearly not being met within sort of mainstream Mormonism for people who are in the liminal spaces outside of sort of the mainstream. And so that, you know, like getting a degree in mental health counseling was really about wanting to address that pain that I was seeing and wanting to figure out the best ways to, and I'm still working on that. I don't know that being in private practice is the best way for me to, you know, like address that, but that's what I'm doing right now. And I'm learning a lot in private practice. Every single client that I have, I learn more about, you know, like how our brains work and how mental health affects us. And they bring me so much wisdom. And so I really enjoy the process of being a counselor. I really like people. And and mostly, not all, but mostly my clients are people who are sort of in liminal Mormon spaces, either people who are in a faith transition or have left the church, or couples who maybe have a mixed faith marriage, things like that.
Okay. Well, that's helpful. And we'll get to know you a little more as we have our conversation today. So our topic of our episode today, Lisa, is let's talk Harvey Weinstein. So not so much about him specifically, but about this whole plethora of celebrities, executives, politicians, talk show hosts, etc., that are in the news right now and swirling around this national conversation and in some cases international conversation about sexual abuse and the gender power imbalance that's a very real aspect of inappropriate sexual behavior and sexual abuse, and how the case of Harvey Weinstein, when Rose McGowan accused him of sexual assault, it just seemed to break open this dam of issues and actions and behaviors and incidents that women have been enduring, and it brought it right into our public discourse. So with that, I'm just really interested in what is it about this, because it's not just an issue about sex. It is also about power. And for the purposes of this podcast, sex, power, and how people of faith process this, live through this, and in some cases, women endure this. So let's talk about this issue of sexual abuse that's in the news right now. So sex and power is not a new thing. What constitutes sexual abuse or sexual misconduct in a workplace? Let's start there. Is it innuendo, sexual innuendo? Is it telling a dirty joke? Is it inappropriate physical contact? Is that what's required to make it sexual abuse or inappropriate sexual behavior? What's the kind of definition there?
Well, I mean, part of the problem is this about definitions, isn't it? Because I don't know that those are clear to anybody necessarily, and they can be so different depending on the context. You know, there are vastly different types of workplaces, and there are vastly different types of expectations, and there are vastly different responses to different kinds of things. I think, like, if we're just talking on an individual level, like, what should I, Lisa, be careful of doing in a workplace so that I'm not, you know, like, harassing someone without meaning to, perhaps, for instance. You know, one of the things that can be helpful to keep in mind is to maybe swap that situation out for another one. So maybe think through, would this joke be appropriate in, would I be willing to tell it, for instance, from the pulpit? I mean, that's not always going to be the definition, right? And depending on who's in the group and how well you know them, like these things might shift. But it really is better in general to be more cautious than less so around sexual information, just because unless you know the histories of the people that you are telling this joke to, for instance, if there's anybody who you don't know, whether they have perhaps been sexually assaulted in the past, you don't necessarily know if this is going to be something that's going to land in a way that feels safe to everybody in the room. And so sometimes, like, changing the context in your mind, maybe you think that these are a few colleagues that you're hanging out with and this joke would be fine. But, you know, like, it's really important to sort of play that out and ask yourself, well, if this context was changed slightly, would it still feel appropriate? Like, if that was President Obama sitting there, would I tell this joke? Was, you know, like, some things like that. So just some mental modeling and practice with yourself to sort of ask, you know, because we don't want to necessarily always be stifled. We want to be able to tell some sexual jokes sometimes in a context where, and that's one of the ways that we release tension, right? But then there's also, you know, like, tuning into people's signals, Like if somebody, you know, doesn't laugh, are you willing to ask, oh, I'm sorry, was that a problem for you? Or, you know, like, I'm sorry, I hope that, you know, you can tell me. And I don't know. In general, though, hopefully you're in a workplace and you've had some training on sexual harassment, and it's generally just going to be wise to leave those kinds of conversations at home or outside of work. You know, church is a little bit fuzzier, right? Because sometimes church is social, more social. But again, it's really important, especially if you're a man. And I know that that feels unfair sometimes to men because they didn't necessarily choose to be born male. And they didn't necessarily, you know, like choose to be in a position of power in that way. But one thing that I think it's important for all men to realize is that just by their very maleness, they are in a position of power because for a variety of reasons. One is just physical, that most men are stronger than most women. And so that puts women in general in a position of weakness. Just physically, we could be raped more easily. We could be hurt more easily. And so that level of power, while nobody necessarily asked for it, that's just a reality that we have to look at. And so realizing that if you're male, you're always carrying around with you, with your body, this power that puts women at a disadvantage. And then another level, there's the way that we as a society have talked about sexuality for men versus for women. And women have always paid a much higher price for sexuality than men have, you know, and that's biological in that we pay a higher price for sexuality. You know, like if we get pregnant, that is a high price to pay. And additionally, that is social, you know, like women have all kinds of names and derogatory language directed at us towards our sexuality. And there's really nothing comparable for men, you know, like bimbo doesn't carry the same, or himbo doesn't carry the same weight as a bimbo or a slut or a whore. Like there's just nothing comparable for men. And similarly, women have been told for a very long time that we are responsible for controlling men's sexuality. We should be appealing, it's too appealing. And we're put in these positions where we just don't have a lot of power and our sexuality is always sort of on the table or up for debate in a way that men's isn't. And that puts us in an additional position with less power. And so, you know, these power dynamics are really complicated because you could be a poor white man and yeah, okay, you're physically powerful and you don't have the stereotypes of sexuality working against you, but you know, here's a very wealthy woman who has financial power. And so it's not like the calculus is ever simple, but just with those two pieces of physical power and social power, there is a weight that men must carry, you know, that whole quote of where much is given, much is expected. If you have power, then you have to work at being aware of the ways that your power might unintentionally harm other people. And so in our discussions of sexuality, men are just going to need to be a little bit more careful about the ways that they talk about sexuality, especially in any situation where a woman might feel like she doesn't have power.
So a lot of the, what we're hearing from men in the public eye who have been accused now of sexual abuse in this power dynamic come up in their sort of public apology statements with this sentiment of, I didn't realize what I was doing was offensive, or I didn't realize that the female that this encounter was reported by felt disempowered or threatened or coerced. So what is it about this power dynamic to where men either consciously or subconsciously are oblivious to the power dynamic?
Yeah, well, that's a really hard question. That there's been a lot of research in the last like 20 years in psychology about what is it, you know, why is it that we are often so blind to ourselves? Why is it that we are often, you know, like up at midnight eating an entire chocolate cake, when that is really not what our goal in life was to be doing, right? So how is it that we can, you know, like have one image of ourselves or one idea of who we are, and then have these other behaviors that we perhaps didn't see clearly, or perhaps didn't understand the ways that they might affect others? And there's actually a metaphor for this that I quite like, which is the rider and the elephant, which is like a rider on a horse, but on an elephant, that we think that we're in charge, that we're the rider that is telling the brain what to do. But there's actually this huge elephant that has sort of got a mind of its own. It knows where its yummy grass is, and it knows where its favorite watering hole is, and it has certain paths that it's trod on a whole bunch of times. And so we all have this elephant brain that is actually much bigger than our sort of conscious self, the part of ourselves that we think is in charge. This elephant kind of does the things that it's been trained to do. And if you've been raised in a society that says that it's okay to speak to women in a certain way, you don't necessarily think that through. You just do it because that's what your elephant does, right? Or perhaps your elephant has been triggered by something. It sees a snake, or it smells a beautiful woman, right? Like, we all have these aspects of ourselves that when that part of our brain turns on, we become less wise, we become less smart. You know, like we see a chocolate cake and we're hungry, we aren't necessarily going to have the self-control that we wish we would have. So those kinds of things, there's so many things that can blind us to behaviors that we perhaps wouldn't be proud of if we were more aware of them, or sort of more in charge of our own brains, or even as in charge of our own brains as we think we are, right? Because the thing about the rider is often not even aware of the elephant. The rider really thinks he's in charge. And it's not until, you know, we have half a chocolate cake in our mouth that we realize, or somebody calls us out and says, hey, this thing you did, that really hurt me. And then you say, oh, I didn't even think about that. I just was doing, you know, like, it reminds me of what Louis C.K. said. He's like, I thought I was asking for permission when I said, hey, can I masturbate in front of you? Like, he really thought that that was consent. And it didn't occur to him that they might not feel, that they might not have the power to say no, or that that might trigger them. And that if they are triggered, they might freeze, which is a perfectly normal response to freeze in the face of danger. You know, his story that he was telling himself, or his belief about what included consent, didn't include an understanding of power dynamics, and it didn't include an understanding of the position he was putting women in. It certainly didn't include an understanding of the ways that women have often been victimized and will often feel triggered or frozen in a situation where they feel powerless. So part of it is educating ourselves about the ways our own minds work. Part of it really working on awareness of ourselves and empathy for others.
So if we use your analogy of that elephant, what seems to be so prevalent in many of these apology statements is that they thought their behavior, that they were asking for consent, or they thought their behavior was, you know, it was a consensual relationship. Now, many of our listeners are aware that what happened in response to all of this is the Me Too movement on social media, where women who have felt that they've been put in a position of sexual abuse, or had been assaulted or molested, or simply received inappropriate sexual behavior from a male, began to post on social media Me Too. started with celebrities, and soon lots and lots of people, at least what was coming through my Facebook feed, were sharing that they too had experienced this. Now, most, not to the level that we're talking about with Louis C.K., but or Matt Lauer or some of the others that have been in the news. But many, many women have been on the receiving end of a male rubbing up against them to show that he has an erection, or making lewd comments about how they are dressed, or just simply physical contact that has not, that the women did not ask for or initiate. So what is it about our dynamic with males in our culture and in our society that men seem to think that that kind of, this isn't really abusive behavior, but it's extremely, in their mind, I think, suggestive behavior. Whereas to women, it is disempowering. It is frightening. It is terribly uncomfortable to receive that kind of behavior. So what is it that gives men permission to think they can speak or touch or grope or coerce? What's going on in how men and women relate today that this is still such an issue?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it does go back to a lot of the idea of the elephant things, right? Like male elephants and female elephants, right on early on, were trained that like certain things were, you know, like society trains us, our parents train us, our peers train us in what kinds of behaviors are okay and not okay. And again, not by any fault of their own, many men are sort of trained not to necessarily think about what women need or want or are supposed to be doing, right? Like they're really tuned into to their own needs and perhaps the needs of men. But that's also one of the ways that power blinds us, right? Like if someone has power over us, then we are more likely to pay attention to, you know, like their needs. If we have power over somebody else, we are less likely to pay attention to their needs. And this is, you know, like when Jesus talks about the ways that power corrupts us, the ways that power blinds us, these are the beams in our own eye, right? Like these are the ways that we become blind. And it isn't necessarily anybody's fault per se. It's just the way that society has been set up forever. And so, again, it comes down to the ways that power blinds us. And so men feel often entitled. And this is, in fact, very variable, the levels of entitlement that men feel. Some men feel a great deal of entitlement. Some men are maybe more aware of that entitlement. But I'm honestly going to say that it's very few men that I've met that don't on some level feel some entitlement to behave in ways that don't necessarily take women's needs or feelings into mind. And that is something that they were trained to do very young. And their elephants just do that automatically. And it's not a thought process. It's not like they think, oh, I'm going to ignore what this woman needs or wants. It just doesn't even occur to them that that's something that they should be taking into consideration. And so that means that if we want a different outcome, we have to do some effortful changing of these habits. That means that we have to put time and effort and energy into undoing these blind spots, into pulling the beam out of our eye so that we can see the world more accurately and understand the ways that we, and this applies to women as well in the areas where we have privilege and power. You know, as a white woman, I have many times said and done things from a position of power that I didn't even really know that I had. One of the ways that that is definitely true is coming from sort of a traditional Mormon culture. I'm super uncomfortable with conflict. And so when women of color would have painful things happen to them, I would sometimes not give them as much energy as they deserve in their pain because I was trying to avoid making other people uncomfortable, generally white people, right? Like the comfort of white people was a priority for me because I was avoiding that conflict over the feelings and the pain of a person of color. And that's something that it took me a long time to see that I was blind to. I had to, you know, like I had to learn that lesson very painfully. And it never feels good to wake up to our own blindness. That feels terrible because then we realize we've been hurting people on accident. But there's no way to undo these problems without waking up to our own blindness.
So I would imagine the Me Too movement and the amount of space that this issue is taking in our public discourse, in our nightly news feed, and on social media, that a lot of men are going back through their minds on, have I engaged in this behavior? I think it's coming out to such a degree that women and men don't seem to have any option but to think about it. It's there. The whole idea.
I think so, but we also have these sort of defense mechanisms, don't we? Like, for instance, again, coming from the point of view of a white woman working with women of color, one of the things that I see happen over and over again is instead of taking the time to like self-examine, we'll often just jump on other people who made a mistake. So instead of like really looking and stepping back and saying, what have I done? Where have I been complicit? Where were the jokes told that I didn't call that man out? Or where did I tell a joke without realizing that it was perhaps? Or where did I say something? Or, you know, instead of doing that inner work, we will often point our finger at the person who was worse than us or the person that has obviously done something bad. And that's a much easier and safer way to feel like you're on the side of the angels, right? Because if you can point at someone and say, well, they did this and this and this, they're such jerks. They're so bad. Those people, they're the problem. And, you know, it's really easy to point at a Louis C.K. or a Matt Lauer and say, oh, that guy, he's so bad. It's a little harder to do some real examining of ourselves and say, okay, well, where have I perhaps contributed to this problem? Have I stood up for women? Have I believed women? Have I listened to women? Has this been on my radar at home? You know, maybe you haven't been part of the problem, but maybe in some small ways you have, or maybe in some larger ways than you realize. Have you asked? Have you asked the woman you love if you've ever done anything? And if you did ask, do you feel like you could hear them? Would you listen? Those are things that are very difficult to do. It's very difficult to open yourself up to correction. It's very difficult. It's really easy to point at Louis C.K. and saying, that's gross. Yeah, that's gross. We solve a lot more things if we can point to ourselves and say, okay, well, can I open myself up to the places where I've been? Can I open myself up to the places where I have perhaps transgressed? And the thing is that, you know, we're all so blind to ourselves sometimes. I remember the first time that I really sat down and started thinking through the times when I have been sexually harassed or sexually abused. I hadn't even registered a lot of them. Like, you just, that's how life is, right? Like, you don't necessarily see it somehow in the moment, or you don't necessarily interpret it as what it is in the moment. And then something like this happens, and suddenly you're looking back on your life and you're thinking, oh, well, that happened to me, and that happened to me, and that happened to me. But then there's the second question of even deeper of like, well, have I been complicit? Have I done things to other people? One of the things I did remember as I was thinking through that is like 25, 30 years ago when I was a freshman, I think, yeah, a freshman in college. I catcalled a young man who was bending over a drinking fountain. I said something about his butt. And I just thought I was being kind of funny and cute. And later his girlfriend came to me and told me that I had really made him feel unsafe. I had made him feel sort of objectified. And I honestly hadn't even considered that that was a possibility. And I felt terrible. I really appreciate that she was willing to come to me and be honest with me like that. And that was really probably a hard thing for her to do. But I hadn't even remembered that I had done that until I really started to dig into my memory. And there it was, you know, like there was a time when I was complicit. So,
and I think for many people, we can search through and find those instances that help us kind of frame this in a different way. I'm curious, as we've talked about this, it's one thing to talk about our workplace or school or secular life, but when we begin to talk about our communities and circles of faith, it seems to be much more difficult to address issues that have to do with sex. I don't know if it's because the subject of sex seems to be taboo or has been labeled as inappropriate for religious settings, or maybe it's simply because we tend to think that the gender power imbalance or even sexual abuse don't exist in communities of faith. And yet they do. They exist and they make themselves known within the church and in the lives even of, quote, good, unquote, people. So as people of faith, how do we have these conversations in ways that help men and women do this more introspective work about behavior and find healthy ways to go forward in communication and in actual living out a more balanced relationship, men and women?
Man, if I had the answer to that, I'd be a millionaire. No. I totally agree that, like, churches are just like any other part of our lives, right? Like, they are just reflections of the larger society, and we have just as many problems with this at church as we have anywhere else. I think that where that becomes a problem is that we, as human beings, really, really love. It feels super good to have a sense of internal consistency. We love it when our beliefs and our ideals line up consistently with the output of what we produce. And so because church is perhaps the place where we want to be our best selves, where we want to be our ideal selves, where we want to, you know, like become more like God and become better people, that it's really, really hard to hold something that it is so wrought with emotion and with power and with shame as our sexuality in that same space. And especially because church has a great track record in general teaching sexuality in healthy ways. And so this is sort of new ground that we're breaking, trying to approach our sexuality and our spirituality in ways that are nourishing to both. And so obviously, like, we're going to be struggling on those grounds. I think that we have made a lot of progress just in even having something like this, a podcast where we're going to talk about faith and sexuality. My goodness, you know, like the fact that we're breaking that ground, that progress. And then obviously, like, sitting down as a faith community and deciding, well, what does healthy spiritual sexuality look like? How do we take into account our desires and, like, our physical desires, our sexual desires, and our spiritual desires, our hopes for each other, and defining what those look like. And I think, honestly, that churches have so much more power to deal with this in healthy ways if churches are willing to have these hard conversations, because our spirituality really is about our whole selves, whereas our work lives are segmented. They're boxed off. There isn't perhaps a place in most workplaces for discussions of sexuality. My workplace is not particularly like that. Like, in my workplace, there's lots of discussions of sexuality, right? But in many workplaces, in most workplaces, sexuality is a part of you that is boxed off and siphoned away. But our faith communities, if we open up the idea of what does sexual healthy spirituality look like? You know, what are God's expectations for us and our sexuality? I think it starts with a conversation. And then I think, you know, there's tons of really great tools out there. I don't know what the community of Christ has available as far as tools to healthy sexuality. I know the Mormon church, mainstream Mormon church, doesn't have much, and what it does have is deeply problematic. But there are other churches who are doing a lot in this area. The Unitarians have a great curriculum. And so I feel like if we are willing and brave to go into those spaces, that this is a place where we can bring our communities a lot of power and hope.
Where do you see this going? It's a giant snowball rolling down the hill. Is it going to, in communities of faith particularly, is it going to bring about positive change? Where do you see this whole snowball headed, this outing of abuse and its effects?
I absolutely agree with the assessment that it's like it's a snowball that hasn't even begun to stop rolling down the hill, or, you know, another metaphor, it's the tip of the iceberg. I feel like when we get down into the meat of this, if, you know, like if it continues to go in the direction that it is, that, you know, like we're going to see that I honestly, and especially in positions of power, I think that there's a lot more to be uncovered. I don't think that we've even gotten to the water level yet of the iceberg yet. And that's probably really scary for a lot of people to think that so many of, I'm super brokenhearted about Al Franken. I just read his book and I really liked him, you know, like, and I want to make excuses for him, you know, like, and I want to believe him and, you know, like, I'm super upset about Donald Trump being president when he, you know, openly admitted to groping women. And I'm super upset about Roy Moore. And I know that there's a certain amount of that is my own blindness to my, you know, like who I see as the good guys or the bad guys, you know, but in the end, I think where this is going is, I mean, my general philosophy of life is that sunlight is the best disinfectant. You know, like the more that we tell these stories, the more it gets out into the public, the more that we will learn to negotiate these very difficult gray areas with more care, with more thoughtfulness, you know, with better boundaries, with better communication. I don't think that men, quote unquote, want to, in most cases, be abusing women, right? It's just that they are blind often to the ways that their behaviors hurt. And so the more we are able to communicate that we are hurting, and the more that men are willing to listen, the more that we will be able to communicate in ways that minimize the pain that we cause each other. I mean, I just think about, like, 10 years ago, if you told me, oh, boundaries, I would not. I mean, like, that's just 10 years ago. I would not have known what you mean by boundaries. Mm-hmm. You know, like,
and yet it's boundaries. Part of our discourse now. Yeah.
Right. Boundaries. What are boundaries? And as a young woman, I had very little concept of the idea that I got to say no. And it wasn't that anybody purposely sat down and told me that I didn't have a right to say no. But, you know, like when I got tickled as a child and I said, no, stop, stop, nobody stopped. Right?
Right.
And when I, you know, like when I got taught in church about, you know, like going in to talk to the bishop, nobody told me that there was a line that about which if he asked me, I could say no, right? Like it didn't occur to me that he could be asking me inappropriate questions. I don't know that it occurred to my parents either. And yet that did happen to me. And even at the time, in that moment, I didn't realize a boundary had been crossed, right? Because I didn't know that I had boundaries that were crossable.
So there's a writer named Damon Young, a columnist at GQ.com, and on VSB.com, he wrote this. Before that can even begin to happen, we have to accept how cavernous this is and refuse any urge to absolve ourselves from it. That means believing women when they express their feelings and experiences with this. It means expanding our definitions of what constitutes abuse and realizing that abusive behavior exists on a spectrum and isn't always aggressive and doesn't always result in visible scars. it might not even be recognized as abusive until years after it happened. It's possessing a sincere want for the world to just be safer, and a recognition of all the things we've done and currently do that contribute to a culture of relentless danger. It's sincerely wanting to divest patriarchy and any other social construct that cultivates, maintains, and protects hierarchy. It's accepting that there are women you've wronged who may never forgive you, and that's their right. And their not forgiving you or even wanting to hear anything from you shouldn't make you throw a tantrum because, again, that's their right. As I first read through this, as a person of faith, I thought, oh my gosh, of course, forgiveness is essential in this. But Damon Young brings up something very interesting in that when he says that some women who have been wronged are just simply not at that point. What would you say to that?
I absolutely agree with him in that. I think that one of the things we do as faith communities is try and rush women to forgiveness. I think we try and rush a lot of people to forgiveness. You know, like sometimes, like forgiveness isn't a choice so much as a process. And forgiveness is not something that's going to happen until the pain and the weight of what was done to that person are fully reckoned with and validated, right? Like, certainly you can, I mean, I think that there are people who can perhaps reach forgiveness very quickly, like a true and deep forgiveness. And those types of people have probably or developed their, you know, like that ability, that from a place, again, of perhaps some sort of privilege, like that perhaps they had such a loving, kind background, or perhaps you just don't know, right? Like we cannot expect people to forgive as a means of helping ourselves feel better, right? Like, we have to forgive ourselves. We have to make things right as much as we can, but we can't put our own growth in the hands of someone else and say, I won't feel better until you forgive me, right? That isn't the way it works. And their process is their process. And in fact, expecting them to forgive us is, again, trying to assert power over somebody else. We have to let them have their process. We have to let them, you know, like come to grips with whatever we did to them in whatever way that they are going to, and let go of that and leave it with God. And then we have to work our own process of truly becoming sorrowful for our the ways that we've hurt others, for truly, you know, allowing that sorrow to change us for the better. Because that's the only way that we're going to become that best self. That's the only, you know, like that's the only way that we're going to grow towards that inner light that we know in our core that we want to grow toward. And, you know, like I truly do believe that the path to that is grace. I mean, that love that comes free from the universe. You know, the sunlight that feeds every plant in the world, that nobody has to pay for. It's a gift from the universe. And if we can believe in that seed in ourselves, if we can truly believe that our desire is to grow towards goodness, then that fear of I'm bad if I admit that I made this mistake, or who am I if I'm the person who wronged others, or the shame of realizing that you were blind to yourself, right? Like those things can be healed through grace, through knowing that, you know, we have this divine nature or this divine desire to grow towards love, and that is our core goodness. And that if we hold on to that goodness, rather than holding on to this belief of ourselves as a good person who wouldn't hurt others, and so therefore I'm not the one who hurt you, or I need you to forgive me so that I can believe I'm a good person again, like the, all those kinds of things. So, yeah, we allowing other people to hurt, that's hard.
So as we continue watching this in our public conversation grow daily, it seems, the issue of sexual misconduct and sexual abuse, it is becoming more and more part of our kind of public awareness. So where do you see this going? Do you think it will eventually empower women or bring positive change in some way? What do you see from happening from this?
I guess I would say I'm cautiously optimistic. Just that might be my own problem, though, because I'm always optimistic. I can't seem to help myself, and that doesn't make my optimism true. I mean, I do believe that sunlight is the best disinfectant, and I deeply believe in the power of telling our stories. I believe that there's so much power and beauty in being real about our stories. I mean, I told some Me Too stories that I had never really told publicly before. I think we have all either told some of those Me Too stories or dug them up, most women anyway, probably many men as well. And this awareness, again, like the more that we can shine light onto ourselves and onto the places where we have a beam in our eye, where we aren't seeing things clearly, the more sunlight, the more awareness and awakeness that we bring to these things. I think that it does empower and improve us all. I think that there's a great deal of power in the sisterhood that has risen up, where women are now, I think, understanding on a level that we perhaps didn't 5 or 10 years ago, how much believing each other and supporting each other in our stories will lead to, you know, like holding people in power accountable for their behavior and holding those people to a standard that everybody else has to live by, that they don't get away with behaviors that hurt because they have power. And just in general, I feel hopeful that slowly we will move toward better behaviors. I mean, I look at my son and he's so much more aware of these kinds of dynamics than we were at his age. He is so much more aware of the ways that he is responsible for the privilege that he carries through the world because he's a tall, handsome, strong white boy, that he must be aware that he has the power to hurt others and he must be careful with that power. I don't think that boys my age had any sense of that at all. And so that's the kind of thing that brings me hope, but I also think it's going to be a slow and painful process because there are so many buried stories. There's so much pain. There's just so much exploitation and trauma that has been sort of the stock and trade of people like me, that we have heard these stories, but you know, they haven't been in the New York Times. They haven't been a daily news story for everybody else the way that they have been for me, right? And so this is a painful awakening. But I also think that, you know, like if we think of that kind of pain as the pain that leads to growth, the kind of pain that comes after weightlifting or hard exercise, right? Like that, yeah, growth is painful. Building our muscles, building our, you know, our resilience, building our capacity for sitting with shame, building our capacity for viewing ourselves from a position of vulnerability, that what we get as a reward is more connection, more realness, more trust, more of the things we really want from each other that make life worth living and make life beautiful.
Well, Lisa, I want to thank you for taking time to visit with us. You've given us lots of ideas and tools for walking with each other towards that place of wholeness. I want to let our listeners know that you've agreed to join us periodically for some other conversations on No Filter, Sex and Faith, so they can look forward to that. And in the meantime, if you would like to hear more from Lisa, you can check out the Feminist Woman Housewives blog, or you can find her at Symmetry Solutions on the web. So thank you to you, and thanks to our listeners for checking out the first episode of No Filter, Issues on Sex and Faith. Join us again for more candid discussions. We'll see you then.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.